That's reggae legend Peter Tosh, a founding member, along with Bob Marley and Bunny Livingstone of the Wailers, with Feel No Way. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Republican presidential candidate and self-professed man of God, Ben Carson, has made it plain the nation's highest office is to be off limits to Muslims. Further, he says, Islam is not, quote, consistent, unquote, with the U.S. Constitution. Carson was a guest on NBC's Meet the Press with host Chuck Todd yesterday. Here's how that question came to light.
Should a president's faith matter? Should your faith matter to voters?
Well, I guess it depends on what that faith is. If it's inconsistent with the values and principles of America, then of course it should matter. But if it fits within the realm of America and consistent with the Constitution, no problem.
So do you believe that Islam is consistent with the Constitution?
No, I don't. I do not. I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that.
And you...
Well, there's a lot that people don't agree with Ben Carson today. We're joined by Zahra Bilou, Executive Director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE is the acronym. And Zahra, I imagine there is a great deal of turmoil in the, not just the general community, but in the Muslim community particularly, and your organization is now calling for Ben Carson to get out of the race.
Thanks for having me on. I'm not even sure that there's any tension. I think people are not surprised, or it's disappointment is probably the best word. His statement and his understanding of the Constitution is inconsistent with the law and makes him less than qualified to run for president in this country.
Well, what is CARE? Why is CARE calling for him to basically get out of the race?
He is spreading bigotry and hatred. He has demonstrated himself as unqualified, and accordingly does not have a place in the upcoming presidential election. We don't think, as a civil rights organization, that someone who would misread and misapply the Constitution and discriminate against a group of Americans based on their religious identity should have a place in public office at all.
This remark comes within a particular context. It comes within the context of, I would say, it's a rising tide of xenophobia, Islamophobia, which has been the case since the 9/11 attacks, a rising case of racism in the country. Do you believe that Donald Trump has created or helped his attitudes, his professed attitudes, have helped to bring this feeling of Islamophobia, this notion that it is us against them, that this idea that Muslims are terrorists and so forth? Do you think that that was exacerbated by the tone of Donald Trump's campaign?
Absolutely. I think that Donald Trump's campaign contributes to it. But I think taking one step back, even from the more recent comments by candidates who are at best described as fringe, our long history of endless war in Muslim-majority countries and law enforcement practices of surveillance and entrapment are also sort of contributors to this, right, is that Ben Carson and Donald Trump would not have fodder to make their arguments with were it not for these longstanding policies of our country. And so they're bringing it to the forefront. And by failing to even disguise their bigotry with some priority for reconciliation or, an understanding of American values at a deeper core in terms of unity and non-discrimination, they are making things worse.
Do you find it odd that this, I mean, people are reacting in pockets, I see, and you know, but as a whole, do you think the country is exhibiting the kind of reaction that says, when all is said and done, people recognize that there are limits to where people could go in terms of maligning entire communities, besmirching the character of people, and behaving in this primitive fashion where you are literally encouraging bigotry and hatred under the guise of Christian dominance? Do you find it odd that we are not hearing as vociferous as I thought we would, as vociferous an opposition to this kind of climate? One would expect that this thing would have created an avalanche of protest, but rather I find it kind of tepid, in very, very, very tempered reaction. How do you see it?
Part of me wonders if that's because the entire list of GOP primary candidates is working from the fringe, is appealing to the extreme, and so people are starting to ignore them. The hopeful part of me thinks that that's why, that there hasn't been as much outcry and backlash against their comments. We've definitely seen some. We've seen some really wide condemnations in some cases, and so I'm hopeful that it's more because people are just expecting this kind of vile rhetoric from those candidates.
But the GOP itself, and this is not really a GOP issue, I would say. This is an across-the-board issue. The demonization of Muslims, which has been longstanding in the United States, despite the fact that Islam and Muslims have a very long history in the United States, predating even the arrival of Europeans in this country. In fact, the pilot, my good old friend who passed away some years ago, Jan Carew, the historian, reminds us that Estevanico, the pilot who had to basically guide Columbus, was Muslim. So we have a history of Muslims participating rather in rather important capacities all through the colonial period. It is estimated that between 10 and 20% of people who were enslaved and brought to the United States were Muslims. So that the Muslim presence in the United States is nothing new. And certainly there's a history of Muslims participating in all facets of life and contributing very meaningfully to the society. We do not see, however, the attributes that are broadly placed on Muslims, you know, they are terrorists. We have reason to be afraid of Muslims. They are, in some cases, infecting the, quote, American culture, unquote, which is essentially the position that Ben Carson is taking, that we need to be on guard for the deterioration of the American culture because Muslims are here. We don't see that attached to, say, Christians. I don't understand, for example, how Ben Carson could come up with these ideas about who is fit or not fit to be in public office by virtue of their religion. Certainly nobody has asked him whether he intends, if he were elected president, whether he intends to be president on the Sabbath or whether he thinks Seventh-day Adventists make good candidates for public office. I mean, at a certain level, it becomes so blatantly bigoted and, I dare say, racist, because it would suggest that Ben Carson doesn't even know his own African-American history.
Right. I mean, you know, to be honest, I would say that maybe the way to think of it is that his comments about who is fit to run for office are more a reflection of him and his fitness than those he speaks of, right? Like, there is nothing more blind to the Constitution, to the fact that there is no religious test for office, that employment discrimination would be a challenge if he were the one making appointments. It is at best a demonstration of his own unfitness to run for office. And we are hopeful that more and more people will call him out. We're definitely disappointed that the GOP has not done a better job of reining in the candidates that are, in the end, further ruining the name of the GOP, right? Is that the GOP won't do well with minority voters if it continues to give a platform to people like Ben Carson.
Now, the task on American Islamic relations is pressing, nonetheless, for Ben Carson to basically get out or be put out of the race. Do you expect that is likely to happen?
Well, he doesn't seem like he's doing so well to begin with. And so I'm hopeful that this will just be more straw on the camel's back that pushes him out further. I'm hopeful that more and more people will heed the call to push him out of the race because, again, not only is he unfit, he's damaging to the party and damaging to American electoral politics more generally.
So what is your or else position? What is the organization's or else position? Get out or else what?
Or else we will continue to show the American public what a bigoted and unqualified individual he is.
Well, that sentiment having been blatantly expressed, how does it therefore equip the Council on American Islamic Relations to now relate to other parties and basically say, listen, we're not going to tolerate this from you either?
Well, we're 501c3, so we can't endorse a candidate or work with a specific party. What we can do is continue to educate the public about what different candidates are doing to ensure that everyone is an informed voter. And so what we're hoping this will do is make clear that we won't lay silent or turn another cheek to un-American hate mongering by candidates for elected office in this country.
Has CARE really taken Donald Trump to task on this?
I think we have started to take Donald Trump to task, and you see Donald Trump, unlike Herman Cain, has not necessarily dug in his heels about Muslims. I think people remain a little bit unclear about where he stands. There are pictures of him circulating on the internet, socializing with Muslims, but he's also made casual comments to the effect of, I love Muslims. I'm not giving him credit. I don't think that he has earned that yet, but I do think that we're seeing him backpedaling a little bit, and that's good.
Yeah, some of his best friends are Muslims, he says.
Well, there you go.
Well, there's hope. I would like to come back to you in another time and really talk about this Islamophobia that we are seeing and putting it in historical context, because I'm sure there you must have tracked a parallel between the attitudes and national attitudes that are being shaped and inculcated and encouraged in the United States and similar attitudes that have been shaped and inculcated in other countries as a lead up to rather catastrophic consequences. Is this a discussion that is happening within CARE?
It is. I think it is looking at what's happening with Muslims in Europe and how much worse Islamophobia is over there is something that is top of mind for us. Of course, also looking at our own country's history and the experiences of groups like Japanese Americans, African Americans, and Catholics in the past and in an ongoing basis for a number of the communities is important, because alone each of our communities, whether we're talking about Muslims in Europe or Japanese Americans in the U.S. or Muslim Americans in the U.S. are too small to take these things on. But if we can work together, identify patterns and trends, look at successful strategies, and push back collaboratively, we will be more successful in stopping the tide of hatred.
Zahra Belu, Executive Director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, thank you so much for being with us today, and an open invitation to return to discuss things in greater detail.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. We'll take this break, and when we come back, a mysterious 23-month gap in Hillary Clinton's emails. And guess what? They have to do with Haiti. Right after this.
Henry Tomato cannot plant breadfruit. Henry Potato. Son of God, I feel no way. It's coming close to payday. I say, no, but I feel no way. Yeah. Every man get pay a quarter's worth.
You're listening to PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Of the 7,945 emails of former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made public so far, 391 of them pertain to Haiti, a country at the heart of several questionable political and financial dealings involving the Democratic presidential candidate and her family and very close friends. Kim Ives, co-founder of the international weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, is with us once more. He is an expert on all things Haitian. He's covered Haiti for a long time, done many documentaries and prize-winning reports on and from Haiti, and he's here to discuss this mysterious gap in Hillary Clinton's emails. Thanks, Kim, for being with us today.
Always such a pleasure to be with you, Eutrice.
Same here, same here. Well, I read your piece and it was intriguing. So let's start from the beginning. What's with this missing emails?
The missing emails, yes. Well, you know, as usual, you're left to a lot of circumstantial evidence, a lot of guesswork. Educated guesswork, let's say, when dealing with U.S. government affairs. I mean, whatever they release in Freedom of Information Act, what they call FOIA releases, is never much because they redact most of the interesting information. You know, I'm sure people have seen pictures of these released documents of all blacked out or whited out. And so all we can do is wonder about the gaps, a little bit like I remember with back in the day of President Nixon, when you had the 17-minute gap on the tape, you know, supposedly because his secretary had hit the pedal or something. Well, you knew there was something in there. So that's basically what happened with Clinton's emails. We see them coming at quite a good clip for the months leading up to December 15th, 2010. And then why did they suddenly stop? Well, our guess is that the election in Haiti took place on November 28th, the first round, I should say, took place on November 28th, and it was a total fiasco, a total disaster. But the Provisional Electoral Council of Haiti came up with two winners who would go to a runoff. That was former First Lady Mirlande Maniga, kind of professorial wife of the professorial former president, Leslie Maniga. And then the runner-up was a guy called Jude Celestin, who was more or less the hand-picked successor, if you will, of René Préval, who was then president. But Apparently, the U.S. took some exception with that. They didn't like Preval's sort of two-timing with Venezuela and Cuba, and particularly Venezuela. He was the one who shepherded in the Petrocaribe deal, which we treated in great length in 2011 with the WikiLeaks documents we were provided with by WikiLeaks. They also, there was a report that Venezuela was prepared to provide $25 million to Jude Celestin for that run, that the second round run. But the U.S. had something else in mind, and that was Michel Martelly, that a former pro-coup cheerleader who was a kind of a vulgar compa, which is the Haitian music style, the popular music style. He was a kind of vulgar compa musician, the kind of guy who would pull his pants down on the stage and, you know, say all kinds of outrageous things. And they said, you know, this guy is our a ticket to control. And sure enough, Hillary Clinton, in the midst of the uprising in Egypt in January of 2011, instead of flying to Egypt to see what that was going on there, she flew to Haiti and basically read the Riot Act to Preval and said, you're putting Celestin out of the race. He came in second. And you're putting Martelly into the race. He came in third. So our guess is that these emails were essentially something that would outline and show the U.S. complicity in overriding the what is always the most sovereign of all national affairs, a national election. They overrode the Haitian Electoral Council, who was supposed to be the final arbiter, and said, no, you're results are not acceptable. We're going to put in our guy.
Now, it's important to note that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time.
Correct. Yes. She was the Secretary of State during that period. And when she flew to Port-au-Prince, it was as Secretary of State on January 30th, 2011. And essentially, the various candidates came to her, and she, you know, struck a pose as sort of an impartial, how can we call, a guide or advisor. But the fact of the matter is the Organization of American States, which the Cuban government refers to as Washington's Ministry of Colonial Affairs, essentially intervened. They sent a group of so-called election analysts, all from Canada and the U.S. with and France, with one, I think, maybe Trinidadian or something thrown in just for color, so to speak.
Literally.
Right, literally. And then they proceeded to say, oh, no, you know, the way you calculated the results wasn't right, and they threw out a bunch of votes. And anyway, they did something that was completely meaningless, as the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR, in Washington did an analysis afterwards, and they showed that their not just their methods, but their whole logic was completely bogus. But it was all moot. You know, the whole thing was just to provide cover for overriding the Haitian Electoral Council. So basically, this was Clinton. And in fact, Utrice, it was just about 3 or 4 months ago that the director general of the CAP, a guy called Pierre-Louis Aupont, who is now the president of the current CAP in the current electoral contest going on in Haiti, that's completely also completely disastrous. We can get into that. But Aupont admitted on the Haitian radio, he said, yes, the results we got were overridden by Hillary Clinton, Cheryl Mills, who is the Clinton's right-hand sort of lieutenant, as people may know, and the OAS. So this was essentially Ricardo Seitenfuss, who was the Organization of American States special representative in Haiti at the time, he called it an electoral coup. He basically was so outraged by what he saw, he spoke out about it, and he was almost immediately canned, fired, and he went on to write a book about it, which is out in French. This was just, typical Clinton. They didn't go in with troops precisely, even though those were of course always right behind the scenes in the form of the UN military occupation of Haiti. But they essentially carried out through this election shenanigans this coup d'etat electoral.
Now, when this happened, and you said in the article, and it appears in the current issue of Haiti Liberté, you said this begins on or around December the 15th, 2010, and this gap, it ends on November the 23rd, 2012. There's this 23-month gap. And it coincides and dovetails very neatly with all of this activity that Hillary Clinton is involved in. And it should be noted also that while all of this is going on, let me first ask you the question. Do you suspect that it was known Hillary Clinton was, in fact, enacting Obama administration policy, or was she operating essentially in the same way as she operated her server for convenience, personal convenience?
Yeah. Well, I think to some extent she was sort of a power within the power, of course, during her period in as Secretary of State, which went up through February 1st, 2013. When she stepped down to be replaced by John Kerry. But I think Obama had to know. He's the ultimate. I mean, that's why the international ruling group put him in power. He's the ultimate sort of conceder and concession maker and compromise maker. So I think he, was well aware of what was going on there. I'm sure in his morning briefings it came up that, they were in the process of carrying out this electoral operation in Haiti. And for sure, this was overseen by Hillary. And I think this is one of the big skeletons in her closet. And, we know that the censors who go through these emails and release them, maybe they're going to, in the coming weeks, release a few more from that period. But right now, it is clear that, this is a sensitive period. I should say, when we received the documents from WikiLeaks in 2011. The documents went from April 2003 to February 10th, the 250,000 cable trove that Manley got from that Bradley Manning.
Edward Snowden.
Bradley Manning's name has changed. It's escaping me for a moment. I'm having a senior moment here.
Chelsea
Manning provided to WikiLeaks. But in those, they were classified. There's about six levels of secrecy classification. And the documents we had were primarily unclassified, which doesn't mean they're still secret. It just means they don't have a higher classification, confidential and secret. But in this period from 2003 to 2005, we were sort of rubbing our hands together, saying, oh, finally, we're going to find out what happened in the 2004 coup against Aristide. But when we got them, there were no cables in them between the embassy and in Washington until March 2005, a year after the coup had happened. So, you know, when we asked Julian Assange, you know, what happened? Where are these? We're missing some. And he said, oh, well, you know, probably those are top secret or core secret documents, and they're not in this particular trove. So we're guessing that's pretty much what's happening with these Hillary emails, is that whoever is, you know, keeping the state secrets is looking at them. Whether it's Hillary's people or whether it's Obama's people, I'm not sure, but they're definitely seeing that releasing these documents starting in December 15, 2010 would be not in the interests of the United States.
Meanwhile, for the entire time that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she absolutely refused to appoint an inspector general, who is essentially going to be the person serving as watchdog over the agency, and who, if hired, might have been able to, you know, sense that things were happening that were quite questionable and blatantly unethical. So she was very careful not to hire an inspector general for the entire time that she was Secretary of State. In the meantime, we have, though, some emails, and you referenced that were vigorous exchange of emails among two other Clintons, and that's Chelsea Clinton and Bill mm-hmm. Clinton and Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton. So yes. Tell us about those.
Well, the one that's been kind of most interesting in the whole trove that has been released in the 400 or so emails on Haiti that have been released. Most of the emails, I have to say, Utrice, are just, you know, really banal sort of exchange about, you know, what this senator or that representative said, or else just the news stories being sort of emailed back and forth. But there's one really interesting email, undated, but clearly written shortly after the January 12, 2010 earthquake, where Chelsea Clinton, Hillary and Bill's daughter, wrote an email, a seven-page letter, which just eviscerates the United Nations and international non-governmental organization response, saying things like, the incompetence is mind-numbing, saying that they were anachronistic and arrogant and incompetent and just, and, you know, she goes through in kind of very Clinton-esque style, making sort of bullet points about how we have to respond. But the essence of her solution to the problem was, Dad, you have to take control of this situation. So a little bit she asked the wolf to start guarding the chicken coop better, but you know, nonetheless, her analysis of the flaws and gaps and unproductiveness of the UN NGO response was totally opposite to the glowing picture that Mom and Dad Clinton were painting to the world, that, you know, everything was going forward, everything's transparent, you know, the world's coming together and responding. And Chelsea's there on the ground saying, oh, my God, this is a disaster. What's going on? We got to do better than this. So very interesting email.
Now, when you put these things together, Chelsea Clinton's emails, I don't know that you've saw a response from either Bill or Hillary, but one would assume that there might have been some kind of response. But knowing now, it's a family affair with Haiti. They're all involved in Haiti somehow, and not in a good way.
Yeah. Well, as you know, the Haitians see it, you know, these two act as sort of the king and queen of Haiti. In fact, there was an article about back in May about with precisely that title. You know, they have played this role. Bill Clinton, in particular, has been worn every possible hat. He was special representative of the United Nations. He was the head of what was called the Interim Haitian Recovery Commission, which was essentially the group of bankers, international bankers, who was set up to manage the $13 billion which Haiti received from world governments and people after the earthquake. And, you know, essentially what he did was channel this to projects like building luxury hotels and building sweatshops. And often, in the case of the sweatshops, for instance, far from the affected earthquake area up in the north of Haiti, in an area called Caracol up by OCAP. To add insult to injury, these sweatshops were built on very productive agricultural land in a nation that is struggling to feed itself, in fact being undermined in feeding itself by the Clinton policies. Bill Clinton has admitted as much. They paved over some of Haiti's most fertile land in the north to put up these sweatshops, which are going to destroy, in passing, Caracol Bay, which just a few years ago was supposed to be what they call a World Heritage Site, and had a pristine mangrove forest and coral reefs, etc. All this is going down the tubes as the runoff from T-shirt manufacturing and so forth is going to be pumped into this ocean there and destroy this area. So this is the kind of thing that this is the kind of helmsmanship that Bill Clinton has carried out, and to some extent Hillary Clinton as his junior partner. So
as we've discussed on this program, her brother even got the loan permit to proceed with mining in Haiti.
Yes, correct. Her brother, Mr. Rodham, forgetting the first name right now, was on the board of one of the companies that received a permit to do exploration and, in principle, extraction of gold from the mountains of Haiti, a process which is extremely hazardous and polluting, because essentially the gold, they think there's about $20 billion of it in the mountains of Haiti, but it's all there as gold dust. You know, Columbus and the other European marauders got most of the good veins long ago, but the gold dust remains there. So basically the way you get at that, you blow up the top of the mountain, you pulverize all the rock, and then you run cyanide through it to get the gold out. But after you run the cyanide, you got to dump it somewhere, and you usually dump it, and it ends up in the water table, and we've seen it around the world, where essentially streams and rivers turn red and blue with pollution, and all the people who are living around the area of the gold mine have to flee. So basically that's what Haiti's fighting right now. And I should also say pass that the company was given was blocked by the Haitian Senate, which put the kibosh on it. But nonetheless, the Martelly government did do their best to see it through. Are you with me, Utrecht? Okay.
Yes, I'm with you. I'm with you. I want to go back for a minute to Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the role that the Clintons played there. What has been, or what would you say was the consequence of their involvement here?
Well, in terms of Aristide, in a way, that's where Clinton got his original political capital. Just to review for the listeners, recent Haitian history, it was in 1991 that President George Bush the Senior oversaw the first coup d'etat against Aristide, who was one of the few democratically elected leaders of Haiti back in on December 16th, 1990. So 7 months later, they had a coup d'etat against him on September 30th, 1991. And Aristide went into exile for 3 years. Clinton, who campaigned on not imprisoning refugees from that coup d'etat, he did, in fact, renege immediately on that promise, even before being inaugurated. He campaigned on it and immediately backtracked and continued to keep sending Haitian refugees to Guantanamo. In fact, you know, the Haitian crisis was the beginning of Guantanamo as we know it today, a sort of a U.S. holding center on an illegally held piece of Cuba. Essentially, the Clinton administration sort of grudgingly finally had to decide to bring Aristide back in 1994 because of the continued resistance and uprising of the Haitian people against that coup. And so it's the first and last time it's ever been done. The U.S. brought back to power a political leader that it had overthrown with a coup. But he was brought back in a cage. Aristide was brought back as a sort of a portrait to bring about the neoliberal restructuring of Haiti. But then what happened, once he got back, he started to backtrack on the deal that Clinton thought he had with Aristide and did not carry out the neoliberal reforms, basically nationalizing state industries, lowering tariff barriers, throwing people out of jobs, et cetera. And immediately, you know, Clinton administration got very mad with him, and they kicked him out. He was maybe going to recoup his 3 years that he had spent in exile, but Clinton made sure that wasn't going to happen. So they ended up at daggers drawn. But the fact that Clinton brought back Aristide on the shoulders of 20,000 U.S. troops got him a lot of political capital. But basically, he's torn through that in the past 20 years, and now his stock in Haiti among the Haitian people is quite low. I would say he put the sort of nail in the coffin back in December of last year when they were kicking out Martelly's prime minister, Laurent Lamothe, and he said, oh, you know, Laurent Lamothe was the best prime minister people of Haiti ever had. And so the Haitian people who were in the streets for years, basically getting Lamothe out, and they were trying to get Martelly out as well, but they were really outraged that Clinton would sort of tell them they were wrong about what they were doing.
With these emails that you were able to put your hands on, the severely redacted emails, and the still missing ones in this 23-month gap, do you expect those emails ever to surface, and would they, in fact, serve as political fodder for change in Haiti, where people are saying, well, look, all of our suspicions were dead on. We were absolutely right about these Clintons.
We'll see if they come out. I mean, I am not really aware. It seems these dumps of cables, I think there are 35,000 total emails. And as far as I know, only about 8,000 have been actually made public. It's being done on a kind of a rolling basis. I'm thinking that, you know, the right wing in the U.S. is, of course, trying to use a lot of this to shoot down Hillary Clinton's presidential candidacy. And once they do that in a kind of a little irony of history, they also provide the Haitian people with fuel to, you know, basically get the U.S. out of Haitian affairs altogether. Because, you know, this is the essence that I think listeners should understand, is Haiti as the first independent nation of Latin America and the first black republic has been heavily penalized and meddled in and occupied and kept down by the U.S. And unfortunately, you know, the Clintons are the most recent and in some ways one of the most overbearing duo of proconsuls that Haiti has ever seen.
Now, one would wonder why, with all of this known, we haven't heard of an investigation, really, of the role of the Clintons in Haiti as part of a criminal investigation. Certainly something that should be motivated by the fact that there's huge conflict of interest here as regards Hillary. All of this is occurring while she was a Secretary of State. And we have all these business dealings. We still have Bill Clinton's, $6 billion missing or unaccounted for properly in this so-called effort to rebuild Haiti after the earthquake. We have the business efforts of her brother, Hugh, trying to get his hands on Haiti's gold and other valuable minerals. We have very wealthy people associated with the Clintons. The reports that I have gotten is that there's a huge buying up of land, very good land, for development and purportedly for developments that will not include Haitians, except as, you know, manual laborers and others. But these are supposed to be for very luxurious homes and so forth. All of this is going on around the Clintons, and somehow they just manage to not have any accountability. They just seem to just slither through the bars. What's up with that, as they say?
Yeah. Well, just on the last point you were making, yeah, what they're trying to do is take the Côte des Arcadins, as they call it. It's sort of the Haitian coast just north of Port-au-Prince, which for years has had kind of lower-end little beaches and resorts on it. But they're trying to turn that into Miami Beach. They tried to do it on an island called Île aux Vaches off the south coast. The people rose up there. Now the people are rising up on the Côte des Arcadins, specifically in the town of Arcaye. And you can't drive now easily up to the north of Haiti because they basically closed off that north road that goes through there. You have to go up over the central plateau. So, you know, the Haitian people are always mobilized and standing up. As for the question of justice, well, you know, I think what we see, Eutrice, whether we look at George Bush or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or any of these, you know, or Henry Kissinger, you know, we see over the years these people commit war crimes, they commit theft, they commit lots of things. They should be dragged before this so-called International Criminal Court. And I remember when that was being set up, I was working at a paper, Haiti Progre at the time, and we went to it, and we were invited to it. It was happening in Jamaica and what they call New Kingston, you know, which is kind of the corporate enclave they keep away from Kingston itself. And, you know, I raised that question. I said, you know, in this court, are you ever going to judge Henry Kissinger? Are you ever going to judge these guys? No. Who do they take? They take, you know, sort of the guys who execute their orders, you know, these low-level people. The names are escaping me right now. This guy, Habre, who's in there in the dock right now, or the guy from Ivory Coast, you know, Africans, people of the third world will be brought before this court. But you never see Bill Clinton or George Bush on the list of people indicted, or Henry Kissinger. No, So, you know, they'll have electoral campaigns, and the Republican right wing will try to use these things against Hillary. But to me, there's kind of a, you know, quote unquote, gentleman's agreement between these two heads of the single U.S. party, this Democrat slash Republican party, which they, you know, never go cross that line, go too far. None of them are ever going to, you know, propose actual legal redress of these things, which, you know, if they were being consistent, they should. But, you know, but I think part of the thing is that they give themselves this sort of, what shall we call it, impunity or immunity, but we should call it impunity, in their conduct of this huge imperialist war machine and sabotage machine that, you know, basically bulldozes democracy around the world.
Kim, always a pleasure to talk with you, and a great, great privilege to share your information. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And hang in there, Yatrice.
I am hanging in there. Thanks again.
Okay,
that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was of value to you. Stay tuned. Up next, the Global Research News Hour. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And a pleasure and a great privilege, as always, to be in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Man, get